You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Hobby Radio. My name is Keith, amateur radio operator, W0NX. The following articles are from the January 2024 The Spectrum Monitor. And we'll begin with Amateur Radio Insights by Kirk Kleinschmidt, NT0Z. NT0Z at stealthamateur.com. Rotator Roulette. As many readers know, I have spent most of the summer and fall ticking off items on a long-delayed honeydew list. This season alone, aided by freakishly warm weather through the month of December, I resealed the driveway, rebuilt my utility trailer, disassembled and sandblasted down to bedrock, stripped and restained both decks, ditto, but with harsh chemicals and a pressure washer, and built a 175-square-foot storage locker onto the east side of my short tilt-over tower, a shed built onto the garage. Phew, that was a lot of work. The last parts of my summer system updates include replacing the coax runs from the hexagonal beam by the shed and the inverted L's. Two seasons ago, I replaced the run of crappy coax that ran from the hexagonal beam feed point to the bottom of the test tower with Davis Berryflex. Hint: need a low-loss LMR-400, RG-8, RG-213 equivalent that can be directly buried, is flexible enough for rotator loops, is made in America by a long-established specialist company run by hams, and isn't horribly expensive. It's still expensive? For HF through 2, Berryflex is one-stop shopping. Buy it directly from Davis RF, or find it on special, sometimes with free shipping, from the usual retailers. I didn't replace the runs from the backyard inverted L box and the tower base box, 104 feet and 88 feet respectively, with Berryflex, because I have about 1,500 feet of 75-ohm RG11 on hand that I secured from a cable TV industry source. Yes, it's half-inch 75-ohm cable, not a big deal, but it has better loss specs than all of the 50-ohm half-inchers. It's rated for long outdoor service drops in any weather, and the price was right, super right. It's easy to attach PL259 connectors to the stuff, and I have lots of experience using it. It works very well. I might not run a full gallon through it above 10 meters, but I haven't run more than 100 watts to any of my antennas since 1993, usually 5 to 10 watts. So that potential issue really isn't an issue. The two coax runs, still designated as temporary according to the master plan for the QTH, haven't yet been buried, directly or in conduit. They're simply lying on the ground, exposed to sun, weather, trailer and mower tires, the occasional size 10 shoe, and whatever. After 3 years of exposure to Minnesota's harsh climate, there were no measurable or visible problems. But to be safe, I replaced the runs. The SWR and return loss curves, as measured in the shack, were fine, but it was simply time. Somewhat shockingly, what I didn't have to replace was the run of 8-conductor thermostat control wire that serves as the power and control cable for my vintage high-gain tail twister rotator. This cable has 8 18-gauge insulated wires inside a tough outer jacket. When I found it at Menards, I didn't believe the verbiage on the spool that claimed it was UV-resistant and rated for outdoor installations in direct sunlight. Thankfully, I was wrong. Although it meets every electrical spec, this cable is shockingly less expensive than real rotator cable that's sized for heavy-duty rotators like the T2X. Because the rotator cable had been laying on the ground for 3 years, I carefully pulled it up and cleaned the entire run with a damp rag, all the while carefully looking for any signs of jacket failure. There were none. The outdoor-rated thermostat wire was unfazed. Who knew? After testing the coax runs, I carefully reconnected the rotator cables and switched on the control box, which had been unpowered for several months because the directional antenna had been disconnected from the shack during reconstruction. I had a friend stationed outside looking for rotator loop issues as I rotated the antenna through a couple of complete rotational arcs. All good. The calibration was right where I had left it. Not that precision is critical with a two-element beam, as the gain is somewhat minimal, and the main lobe is quite broad. Considering that harsh sunlight and 100-degree temperature swings had utterly destroyed various cables in years past, I was very pleased with the RG11 and the thermostat cable. I was also pleased with the venerable T2X rotator, which had been sitting inside my tower base for 3 years of infrequent use, after 40 years of outdoor service at some other shack, in frequent hardcore weather and environmental conditions. Modern rotators as durable as the old high gains are probably still being manufactured, but they now cost hundreds and even thousands of dollars, even the very same high gain models. Being value conscious, I bought mine from an old timer. It was a 1979 model, having been built when I was a junior in high school. As detailed in a column some 3 years ago, I rebuilt the rotator, cleaned the insides, replaced 100-plus ball bearings, probably unnecessary, as I discovered that someone had already done this not too far in the unit's past, switched the old grease to Arctic-rated lubriplate, etc. I managed to correctly index the upper and lower housings and the position indicating potentiometer on the first reassembly attempt. That's the only real challenge to refurbishing these beefy rotators. Get that right and you're home free. Which leads us into this month's ultimate topic, rotators. They can be expensive, but they're necessary if you need to twirl a directional antenna. Whether new or used, getting the right unit could easily set you up for long-term success. The opposite is also true. Here are some tips. Getting it right. Unless you have a rhombic farm, a foursquare, or some other electrically steerable array, almost every directional beam antenna requires a rotator. I prefer antennas that are electrically steerable, instant direction switching, or provide omnidirectional gain, difficult at HF and not always desirable. But for most of us without a back 40, as in Acres, the antennas we really want almost always require some kind of rotator, whether powered or Armstrong. Many of us have never owned a real rotator. TV rotators, especially modern models, are suitable only for the smallest ham radio antennas and often fail early, even if they're treated well. And there are a great many junky rotators out there, in all price ranges, but especially among low-priced models, so you really need to do your homework before plunking down cash. Swapping out rotators is a lot more difficult than changing radios or accessories in your shack. Switching radios is easy, but removing the rotator from the top of your tower or antenna mast, rigging the new rotator, and reinstalling it is more difficult and more dangerous. If you live in snow country, working atop towers is difficult or impossible for several months each year. Many hams, especially old-timers, think that modern rotators aren't built as beefy as their antique counterparts. A few models aside, they're probably right. But even if most modern rotators aren't massive and overbuilt as they once may have been, learning how they work, how they're rated, and how to correctly and safely install them will still help you choose the best rotator for your needs and your budget. Speaking of budgets, let's just get this out of the way. Regardless of capacity, there aren't any inexpensive, decent quality antenna rotators available at retail. They all cost too much, and they all probably cost more than they need to. But because of small market sizes, prices remain high. You can find deals on used and abused rotators if you're handy enough to rebuild them. Getting exact parts for long obsolete models can be challenging, so consider limiting your efforts to units that need to be disassembled, cleaned, adjusted, and properly lubricated. There are plenty of these available if you can dig them up. High-gain CDE models, such as the Tail Twister, Ham-M, Ham-3, and Ham-4, probably are the best choices for rebuilding, as most parts are still available even new. Parts for other models, such as my pile of Alliance HD-73s, may still be available, but they're a lot more difficult to source. The secondary market for refurbished rotators has surged in recent years, and as with anything that's refurbished, the value of such devices often hinges on who refurbished them, their skills, and their attention to detail. The classified ads at eham.net and elsewhere have regular listings for rebuilt rotators that cost about 30% to 50% of the cost of similar, overpriced, new units. Many local clubs have a rotator person who knows a lot about rotator innards and probably fixes and rebuilds them on the side. Finding a good rotator person is an excellent idea, so be sure to ask around. The ideal rotator person seems to be an old-timer who has rebuilt dozens of rotators for fun and as a sideline hobby business. Buy this person a coffee and introduce yourself. Dark days. For years, if you wanted to buy a refurbished rotator from a long-established company with a consistent history of quality, but an unfortunate name, you could always rely on Norm's Rotor Service. Prices were close to retail, however, but expertly rebuilt rotators and dozens of parts, especially for Reliance rotators, were available. But no more. Norm's site is gone, and Google says the business has been closed for good. A somewhat similar site, once known as RotorDoc, but more recently as CATS, formerly known as Rotor Doctor, is in the process of shutting its doors. Many high-gain rotator parts are still available from high-gain MFJ, but beyond that, who knows? I can't even berate Norm for his company's name anymore, which happens to trigger a pet peeve of mine. Here's my usual rant. Helicopters have rotors, as do automobile brakes. Antennas have rotators. No exceptions. Saying it now seems kinda hollow. R.I.P. rotator folks. Rotators 101. When it comes to amateur radio rotators, myths, legends, folklore, and misinformation abound. All factors considered, the best upfront advice concerning these necessary beasts is to simply buy more rotator than you need, and don't try to spin a big stack of ham antennas with a $100 TV rotator. Simply, antenna rotators are motorized, weather-resistant gearboxes that mount atop your tower or support mast to aim your antenna in the desired direction. Most ham radio rotators have distinctive bell-shaped housings, but some are box-shaped. An internally mounted AC or DC motor turns a gearbox or gear mechanism, planetary or worm, to slowly steer your antenna back and forth. Also, inside is a position sensor that lets a shack-mounted control box accurately display the direction your antenna is pointed, and a braking mechanism to prevent your antenna from moving once it's aimed. A multi-strand control cable usually runs between the shack-mounted control box and the tower-mounted rotator. Some rotators require only a few wires, while some require a whole bunch. Generally speaking, the wires related to position sensing can be smaller than those carrying power to the drive motor. Although somewhat similar, there are enough variations in drive motors, gear mechanisms, and position sensors to make things potentially confusing. Many specific parts depend on the rotator's capacity. Although surprisingly similar from a functional perspective, the gearbox and braking mechanisms required to rotate an 80-meter Yagi and hold it in place during gale force winds are much beefier than those required to handle a small 2-meter beam on a calm afternoon, and a lot more expensive. Exactly how you mount your rotator to the top of your tower or antenna support mast makes a huge difference in its capacity and expected longevity. Most antenna towers have a rotator shelf in the top section to support the rotator and transfer rotational forces to the tower, which is much sturdier than the rotator itself. Make sure the bolt patterns of the rotator and the mounting shelf line up correctly prior to installation. If they don't, you'll have to drill more holes or fabricate an adapter plate. It's important to note that shelf-mounted rotators have at least twice the capacity of mast-mounted units and are much more likely to remain functional and trouble-free. For tower-mounted rotators, the use of a thrust bearing at the very top of the tower is an ideal way to extend the service life of your rotator and keep it from self-destructing. The idea is to mount the rotator in the center of the tower while extending the rotating mast vertically through the thrust bearing at the top. The thrust bearing isolates the rotator from side to side and up and down forces. Remember, the rotator's main job is to steer the antenna left and right and absorb any rotational forces, torque, that are present. If the rotator isn't subjected to other forces, it will function at its rated capacity, work better, and last longer. Not every antenna installation is tower-based, however, so most rotators can be mast-mounted, which sometimes requires model-specific and needlessly expensive adapters. The bottom of the rotator is mounted to a fixed support mast, while a rotating mast with attached antennas is mounted to the top part of the rotator. With no thrust bearing and no rotator shelf to safely transmit mechanical forces to the tower, all of those forces must be handled by the rotator itself, and the effective capacity of the rotator is typically cut in half. If your antenna rotator is rated for 10 square feet of antenna load while tower-mounted, it can safely handle only 5 square feet when mast-mounted. This is critically important. Capacity. The most common performance specification for amateur radio antenna rotators is wind load, typically measured in square feet in the U.S. Simply, if a rotator is designed to handle a maximum wind load of 20 square feet, that means it can handle an antenna or antennas with a total or combined wind load of 20 square feet while properly tower-mounted with a mast of a reasonable length in reasonable weather conditions. A rotator's wind load rating isn't absolute, and it doesn't allow you to violate any and all physical laws as long as you keep the wind load totals under the rotator's design limit. Most rotators with capacities beyond a few square feet, for example, will also list their braking or torque specifications, which indicate the point at which the rotator can no longer hold an antenna in a fixed position. If your antenna's wind load specs are within your rotator's rating, but your antenna has an extra long boom, for example, the extra torque transmitted to the rotator may cause it to fail prematurely or spectacularly. The same goes for the antenna mast, especially if there is no thrust bearing in the system. If you install a 15-foot mast into a rotator designed to handle a 6-foot mast, the additional leverage will probably cause it to fail prematurely. The extra long mast may also cause your tower to fail as well, so don't think you'll just be sacrificing your rotator. Long boom antennas and excessively long masts are premier rotator and tower killers. Rotators come in a variety of capacities, from wind loads of about 3 square feet for models designed to aim small TV antennas, poorly and not for very long, to monster-sized units that might as well be built from tractor parts. Mid-sized units are rated for wind loads of 5 to 15 square feet, and the mega models handle larger arrays from 20 to 50 square feet. Prices start high and go higher, so do your homework before buying. Control boxes and accessories. Basically, a rotator's control box sits in your shack and displays the direction in which the antenna is pointed. Knobs or buttons allow you to point the antenna in the desired direction and engage or disengage the rotator's brake. Most rotators ship with functional, but often visually unappealing, control boxes. Some manufacturers offer deluxe control boxes, as do some third parties. Expensive. Basic control boxes typically don't incorporate digital interfaces, so if you want your login or rig control software to steer your antenna, you'll have to upgrade the control box or purchase a third-party digital interface. Some companies also offer kits or upgrade boards that add delayed braking capabilities or swap LEDs for less reliable incandescent bulbs. Although it looks cool in the movies, setting your logging software to continuously swing your beam back and forth as every call sign is captured and looked up in a location database is a great way to kill your rotator before it's time. Digital interfaces and digitally controlled third-party rotator controllers cost several hundred to several thousand dollars. But thanks to the explosion of open-source, do-it-yourself microcontroller development systems, Arduino, Raspberry Pi, etc., homebrew kits and equivalents are also available for adventurous do-it-yourselfers. More tidbits. If you need to aim a 3-element 6-meter Yagi or a short boom 2-meter beam, you'll probably do fine with a farm store TV rotator. Modern models are all made offshore and have plastic junky parts. They typically fail early and fail often, however. So if your antenna is difficult to reach, expect replacement hassles if the rotator dies in the middle of winter. These critters can't be tower shelf mounted, but they're not beefy enough to handle tower mounting anyway. Most TV rotators have synchronous motor controllers that require frequent recalibration. Easy, but annoying. But you can find them on sale for $50 to $80 if you're lucky. Don't overload them. Old-school units in good condition may be better built than their modern counterparts. When it comes to medium-duty units designed to handle wind loads of about 10 square feet, consider rebuilt high-gain HAM models, or new Yaesu G450A or other G-series models. And if you're going to spend more than $400 on any rotator, Yaesu's G800 series, rated for wind loads of at least 16 square feet, is well-received and costs about half of what competing units cost at retail. The potential problem with Yaesu rotators? Many consider them impossible to rebuild and/or impossible to source parts. Your mileage may vary. We'll continue this article next time. Thank you for joining us for Hobby Radio. My name is Keith.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.